In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
In this state, we've forgotten how to be winners. Losing has become a way of life. We've lost the expectation not only that we can win, but that we will win. Winners expect to win. Here in Oregon, especially if you're a Republican, we expect to lose. In the field of management, there's an area of study called change management, how to take failing companies and turn them around, yes, but it's also about how to change the culture, dynamics, and mindset of teams and sectors within a company, especially ones that have learned to lose. One of the first things you need to do as a change manager is teach your team how to win again. You have to show them that victory is possible, that by following your lead, you can lead them to victory. Oregon needs that. As you heard last week, Democrats are leading us to universal health care. They're looking to raise taxes and feed the bottomless pits of government. Without more Republican legislators or a Republican governor, Oregonians will be left powerless to curb the Democrats' desire to run our lives and spend and waste our money. We have to stop this. I'm here to tell you today we can. On today's show, you'll hear about one victory of a man who is facing the worst that the left could throw against him. You'll also hear about the next lawsuit he faces and how defeating that dragon could have global implications. And there's even some good news on that front. And then we'll talk with someone who knows all about winning. Captain Greg Wooldridge, a 3-time commander of the world-famous Blue Angels, has now decided to run against the vaunted Democrat machine here in Oregon. Stay tuned to hear how he not only plans to win, but how he'll also make Oregon a winner again. I'd like to welcome now Dr. Tim Ball. He is a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg, a Canadian geographer and historical climatologist, but he's best known for his public opposition to the so-called scientific consensus and the whole global warming controversy. Dr. Tim, it's great to talk to you today.
Well, thanks once again for the opportunity. I really appreciate being able to present both sides of the issue.
Good. Well, you know, we wanted to have you on because a couple of weeks ago you had some incredibly exciting news. Longtime listeners of iSpy know that you were involved in multiple lawsuits where you have been alleged to have defamed people. This is a Canadian judge has dismissed all charges in the lawsuit brought against you by British Columbia Green Party leader Andrew Weaver. And that was in response to an article of yours in Canada Free Press. Why don't you go ahead and fill us in about that?
Yes, well, that as you mentioned, that's just one of the 3 lawsuits that I received, all from the same lawyer, all filed in the Supreme Court of British Columbia, and all filed on behalf of members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And, of course, that's the UN agency that has been, in my opinion, corrupting the science and directing the focus against CO2 and implementing or trying to implement all the policies against that. This is a very, very important victory. I now have to go on for the next case, which involves a major piece of research produced by the IPCC called the hockey stick.
Yes.
In some ways, that one's important. But the Weaver trial is important because he was a author in 4 of the IPCC reports, 1995, 2001, 2007, and 2013. And he was a lead author in the computer model chapters. And, of course, it was through the computer models that they created the illusion that human CO2 is causing warming. In fact, the only place in the world where a CO2 increase causes a temperature increase is in their models. So to have that in the record is very important. And one of the things that happened, interestingly, with this was that Weaver called no witnesses at all. But we were allowed to bring our witnesses into trial and their statements. One that you and the listeners would be interested in was by Judith Curry, who, of course, was attacked for her changing her views on what was happening with climate change.
That's right.
But she wrote a superb statement that the judge commended.
Well, in terms of getting this dismissed, of course, your critics are immediately jumping in. And there was actually an interesting article on Dismog blog. And we'll post that up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page. And I'd like to give you a chance to respond to their criticism. They say that your suit was dismissed because the judge said that you weren't credible enough to warrant a libel case. And they go on to cite a couple of things here from the court case. I'll just use this one here. It says the article is poorly written and does not advance credible arguments in favor of Dr. Ball's theory about the corruption of climate science. Simply put, a reasonably thoughtful and informed person who reads the article is unlikely to place any stock in Dr. Ball's views, including his views of Dr. Weaver as a supporter of conventional climate science. What were you saying in response to that?
Well, it's laughable. I mean, I hate to say that. I hate to be an ingrate because I got the verdict that I wanted. The case was dismissed. But I think that this was a sop by the judge to Weaver and his power, political power within the province of British Columbia here. The judge started the case. His opening line was, this court will not be used to settle the global warming debate. And of course, what he's saying by that is what all of the courts say, and we need to discuss this issue of how the courts are unable to deal with scientific issues, and yet they're a major part of our society. But the courts say that we won't get involved in scientific debate. Justice Scalia said, you know, I'm not a scientist. I can't decide. Basically, it comes down to your paper against my paper. So having said that, his opening statement, and of course, implying that the courts aren't qualified to judge, the judge then became qualified to judge my article as to its efficiency.
Yeah, he's not just a scientist, but he's apparently also an editor.
Yeah, exactly. And so, as I said, I think this was a sop to Weaver, because I've got to be honest with you, I did not expect the verdict I got. Huh. I thought that, and my lawyers thought that at best we would get, okay, a dollar fine, you shouldn't have said it, and work out the cost between you, but to come out and say that the case is rejected completely is quite amazing. So as I said, I think that he thought that he had to balance the books with it. But that, hey, you know, that this is the problem when you go to court. You get these bizarre rulings and bizarre ideas, but the final analysis, the record shows, you know, it doesn't matter what happened during the game. It's the score at the end that counts.
That's right. You know, I'd just like to add that Dismog Blog is run by a PR firm specializing in smearing global warming skeptics and was actually founded by a leftist who made a great deal of money by laundering money through Canada's carbon tax schemes. Let's go and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Dr. Tim Ball and his lawsuits, and especially the one coming up. The one against the world-famous Michael Mann of the hockey stick. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Tim Ball, talking about his recently dismissed case. And it's interesting, as you read some of these articles about this case, and you really have to think, as a reader, what kind of chilling effect that these kinds of lawsuits can have on people that just want to voice an opinion and their free speech?
Well, of course, that's part of the purpose of the lawsuit, is the chilling effect on others that would dare to question. Yeah. It's Voltaire summed this all up, you know, when he said that it's dangerous to be right in matters when men in established positions are wrong. And so the chill effect, and added to that, by the way, is that I've had scientists say to me, look, we agree with you on the science of it, but we're not going to say that publicly, because the minute you say that you question the anthropogenic global warming, you're categorized as right wing, and we're not, we're left wing. So you have these people with political and moral dilemmas, but the chill effect is truly frightening. If I tell you that so far my legal bills are $600,000, and that's only halfway through. In other words, without the financial support of a lot of people, there's no way that I could defend myself. And I would either have to withdraw what I wrote, which of course is exactly what they want, the silencing, or I would have to say, no, I'm not going to show up to defend myself, and then the courts could rule and punish me as they saw fit. So it's very, very frightening. And of course, the other thing is the what it does to your family. I mean, I haven't been very vociferous about this, but I talk with my grandchildren about these issues, and my grandson, who goes to a school here in BC, and the teacher, who by the way is very much a supporter of Dismog Blog and that whole David Suzuki Foundation organization, and I say that because Dismog Blog was founded and is funded by James Hogan, who is the chairman of the largest environmental group in Canada, and he also has the largest PR company in Canada, and most of his clients stand to benefit from eliminating CO2. But anyway, I talked to my grandson about it. The teacher made a comment in the class, and my grandson questioned it, and he stood in the hallway for a month after that. Mm. And I mean, it's child abuse, and these are the things that make you think twice about challenging authority. And as I said, I hate to tell that story because it will intimidate other people, but if you're going to fight for freedom, you pay one hell of a price, and you better be ready when you stand up.
That's right. Absolutely. And but it is very terrifying to think that the government can come in and try to shut down people's rights to speech. Now, I have to say, though, that overall, February was a pretty good month for you, because on February 1, Michael Mann, the world-famous Michael Mann of the hockey stick fame, made some concessions to you, which allows him to keep his data secret from the public for another year, concessions that you're apparently not able to talk about. And then, of course, in the middle of the month, you've got this dismissal. So is Mr. Hockey Stick, Michael Mann, is he nervous now?
Well, I hope so, because one of the rules of hockey is that you're not allowed to play with a broken stick. So the hockey stick has been totally broken by scientific analysis. But the key thing with it is that the source code, that is the code that's used to program the computer to produce the results that he did, in other words, to create the hockey stick, he still hasn't released that. And of course, without that, you can't do what science must do, and that is reproducible results. So if he claims something, he should provide all of the data and all of the source codes. And it's very much like everybody's gone through this in a math exam. The one single instruction you always get is show your work.
That's right.
It is absolutely essential to
that. At the time that he did that, was he not working for a publicly funded entity?
Well, of course, that was the issue, and that was when Ken Cuccinelli, who was the Attorney General of Virginia at the time, brought a lawsuit against Mann and said, look, you need to release this information so we can confirm that what you found is correct. And Cuccinelli argued, look, the taxpayers pay for your research, and therefore the data belongs and the research belongs to the
public information. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, of course, as Cuccinelli pointed out, your research results have been used for global energy and environment policies that have cost the world trillions of dollars.
That's right. Yes.
All right. It's all based on that. And so, but here's what happened in a U.S. court in the Cuccinelli case. The judge ruled that that information was Michael Mann's intellectual property. Okay, and therefore he does not have to disclose that, even though somebody else paid for it, which is a very, very interesting question in the light of all the intellectual property battles that are going on with the China and everything else.
Well, not even just intellectual property battles, but you could absolutely lie in a public situation like that. You're working for the government, completely make up data, and then never have to produce any of it. I mean, that's a terribly chilling precedent.
Well, of course, what's happened in my lawsuit is that I took the defense of truth at the risk of going, having everything taken and a fine and going to jail, because I had to have discovery. I had to have a court case which required that he produce these documents. He has not produced them. He then sought, about a month before the actual scheduled trial date, he asked for an adjournment. The problem is in Canada, and I was opposed to it, but the problem in Canada is the courts will always provide an adjournment before the case begins in the hope of an out-of-court settlement to save time and money and so on. But the agreement was that he would still produce the documents by the date of the original trial, which was February 20th.
You'll just have to offer that, you know, you'll withdraw your case as long as he refunds all of the money that the climate scientists have gotten. So there we go. All right, we do need to take a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Dr. Tim Ball after this. And well, back, we're talking today to Dr. Tim Ball about the dismissal of his defamation case that was brought against him. Dr. Tim Ball is best known for his opposition to the so-called consensus in global warming, although I have to say Britain right now could maybe use a little of that global warming. You know, the UK, of course, was not supposed to be seeing any snow. These kids were never supposed to know what snow was, according to many of these predictions just a decade ago. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the importance of your case, though, in the wider realm of things, because Canada has an interesting series of legislation called SLAPP. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that? It's S-L-A-P-P.
Well, it's not actually legislation. It's an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And it's been created by lawyers and politicians who are increasingly concerned about the misuse of the law to punish and silence people. And that, of course, is the very antithesis of what the law is designed to do, to protect free speech. And so in many places, many states, I don't know the number, but at least 30 of the states have what they call now anti-SLAPP legislation. In Canada, 8 of the 10 provinces have anti-SLAPP legislation, which is why, of course, the cases against me were filed in British Columbia, because we had anti-SLAPP legislation, and then a new government got in and got rid of it. If you look at the Michael Mann case, for example, here's a citizen of America from Pennsylvania filing a lawsuit against me, a Canadian, in a British Columbia court about something that happened in Manitoba. This is another part of it. It's what they call jurisdictional shopping.
That's right.
That you go around and find the jurisdiction that will allow the lawsuit that you want to attack people. And so it's a perversion of the law that is really quite disturbing. And as I said, the anti-SLAPP legislation that people are starting to look at is a measure of that.
What do you make of the fact that one attorney has brought these three different cases against you?
Well, it's interesting because he made a name for himself defending free speech. And yet, here we are with lawsuits that are silencing free speech. And now, the good news is that the new government that just got elected in British Columbia here have filed to introduce anti-SLAPP legislation again. And it's going to be very interesting to see how Weaver, who brought the lawsuit that he lost to me, sitting in that legislature, how he's going to vote on it. Because he has the balance of power. He's got three seats, but he's got the balance of power. And that, personally, I find very disturbing that you can have three people controlling the whole legislature, but that's part of the problem of having more than two political parties, which is where, of course, the Founding Fathers understood that. But on a larger scale, of course, the Michael Mann case has much more implication globally because, as I said, the whole world has been duped by this whole global warming or due to humans scam, and that's why I call it the greatest deception in history.
Oh,
there
absolutely.
Have been large deceptions. Yeah, there are large deceptions, but none that are global in their implication.
Well, and none that have cost trillions of dollars, or would have cost hundreds of trillions of dollars, if somebody like a Hillary Clinton had gotten in and pushed through the Paris Accords.
Oh, exactly. And here's the thing. Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote the book The Skeptical Environmentalist, now he's a statistician, but he just published a thing recently in which he took the Paris Accord and said, okay, what happens to global temperature if every country fulfills its mandate under the Paris Accord. And he calculated that it would reduce global temperature by 0.74 degrees Celsius by the year 2050 at a cost of trillions of dollars. And so, yeah, I mean, the implications of this are truly frightening. I mean, think of all the things that could have been done with that money that we really need to address. But this is the problem.
So $100 trillion to possibly change the weather or the mean global temperature by 0.7 degrees. Could the average human standing in a room even be able to tell the difference between those two?
No, and we can't even measure it because we measure we can measure to thousandths of a degree, but because the historic record could only measure to zero or half a degree Celsius, then all the modern record can only use zero or half a degree Celsius in order to be able to see the trend of the temperature. So when they talk to you about when you hear any temperature reading that isn't zero or 0.5, it's a statistic. And, of course, as we know, statistics, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, and that's what's going on. And it's very interesting because on the blade of the hockey stick that Michael Mann produced, you've got he's showing that there was no temperature increase for 1,000 years, and then suddenly in the 20th century, the temperature went up 0.6 degrees Celsius in about 100 years, and he's claiming that that has never happened before. But when you look at the data shows 0.6 plus or minus 0.2. So it's, in other words, it's 0.6 plus or minus 33% error factor. And the guy that produced that data, Phil Jones, who was the head of the climatic research unit in East Anglia and one of the members of the IPCC, Warwick Hughes, an Australian climatologist, said, "We'd like to look at your data. How did you get that number?" Jones wrote back and said, "Why should I give the data to you? It took us 25 years to produce it, and all you want to do is find fault with it." And he refused to give it to him.
Wow, the absurdity of that is just beyond belief. You know, unfortunately, we are up against the clock.
Very quickly, though. Yeah, very quickly. But here, they filed a Freedom of Information request for Jones to disclose that data. He came back and said he'd lost the data.
Wow.
Frightening.
Well, you know, judging from the amount of snow falling in the UK, Phil Jones may not even be able to drive into work today. So there's his global warming. Dr. Ball, I want to thank you so much for your time. What a relief this must be to you and your family. And good luck as you continue to press the fight against Michael Mann. And let's all hope for a great outcome on that one as well.
Thank you. And thank you so much for what you and Carla and iSpy are doing to present all sides of an issue so people can make up their own minds.
Up next, someone else who knows how to win, Captain Greg Wooldridge, who's running for governor as a Republican. In case you're just joining us, we just wrapped up with Dr. Tim Ball, one of the leading skeptics in the fight against global warming. He just won one of his three court cases where he was accused of defaming scientists who want the world to spend $100 trillion or more to possibly lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree, maybe, or at least they hope. You know, it's always nice when good guys win. Speaking of good guys, there's a new candidate in town. I'd like to welcome Captain Greg Wooldridge to the show. He is a former Navy pilot, the only commanding officer to lead the famous Blue Angels team on three separate tours, and he is now running for governor. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mark. I'm glad to be here. This is awesome.
Yeah, you know, it's great to talk to you. You're a former Navy pilot, a commander of the Blue Angels, which are absolutely amazing. Had the chance to see them once up in Hillsborough. Especially considering the precision, not just of the pilots, but the entire crew. You commanded a naval base as well, and you're a motivational speaker on high-performance teams, speaking to audiences about what it takes to lead high-performance teams like the Blue Angels. You've had a tremendous amount of success, and you're out there, retired from the Navy, enjoying the fruits of a life well-lived, and suddenly you decide to run for governor. Was there a tipping point for you? Did something happen, or the governor sign something that made you say, "That's it, I have got to do something to turn Oregon around"?
Well, I kind of got drafted into this, but I am so pleased that they found me. Late last summer, a couple of friends of mine who both have served in the Oregon, one in the Senate, one in the House, came to me and said, look, we've got an idea for you that we've floated around the state, and it's getting wide applause, and that is that you run for office. And I said, oh, come on, you know, I've never held office before. And they said, no, that's good. No voting record. That's a good thing. And over a couple more of my objections, they said, no, that, you know, we can work. We can make that work. And I thought about it. And I finally, after watching the field and then just watching Kate Brown just continue to do this nonsense and not solve the problems in Oregon. And Oregon's in a tailspin. Let's face it. It's heading for the ground. If we don't get somebody in there to fly that airplane that knows how to run, you know, has the courage and the leadership, I think that's the big thing that's missing. And I feel like, because of my experience in the military, and then even after that, and going around talking to folks and seeing the leaders in these major companies and minor companies and seeing how they lead, all that exposure to that has really put a lot of arrows in my quiver to pull when I need it, leading things. And that's what I'm fired up about. And, you know, yeah, like you said, I could have gone on to do some of those other easy things in life, but I've never run from a challenge. I've run two challenges, and that's what I feel here. This is a challenge. It's an opportunity to take this beautiful state, this great state, and the great people here, and put it at the top of the state's list instead of at the bottom where it ranks in so many areas.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Oregon is doing terribly right now. Unfortunately, our media doesn't always do a good job of covering that. But, you know, you mentioned the field. And we know that you're a conservative, and among your Republican opponents, there are two other conservatives out there. Bruce Cuff, a lot of people are saying he doesn't really appear to be a serious contender, but there is also Sam Carpenter, who also has a background in business. Why did you jump in if there's already two conservatives in the race? And also, why should a conservative support you over these other two?
Yeah, well, I like Bruce and I like Sam. They're good guys. How do I put it? I think I would be a better leader, and I think I can beat Kate Brown, and that's the issue. I can beat Kate Brown, and that's, I'll let the competition between us three conservatives go its route. I think people will pick me because I have that drive. I have that passion for the job. I want to build the trust between myself, not only myself, but state government and the electorate and the people of Oregon. They don't trust state government. And that's, you know, I think I have some tools. I have some, you know, I just have the passion to make that happen. And so, you know, you want to separate me from Sam and Bruce? I don't know. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I could, but that's not really what we want to talk about, I don't think. So, I bring it. So,
well, you mentioned trust, and that is such a huge, integral part of building successful teams. And I think you're right, is that most people don't trust government. In fact, that's the whole point of the iSpy show, is that we don't trust government. We're keeping an eye on big government. How do you go about getting that trust rebuilt, not only between people and their government, but even within the government itself, between those different agencies?
Right. Well, you know, of course, Dennis Richardson, our new, relatively new Secretary of State, is doing an awesome job with the challenge of doing the audits on all the agencies, and he's revealing so much waste. Most of his audits aren't applauded by Governor Brown. They should be. It's cleaning things up. That's where you start building that trust. And should the agency heads be the ones that are, you know, allowing that to happen? Well, then we get new wingmen out there, right? We get a new formation of people that are going to head in the same direction, and now we have trust within the government itself. And once we build that trust within the team, can emanate that out to the public and get the veracity and get their, just go back to that word trust, get them to understand that we are being honest, open, and real with them, transparent, no secret handshakes, and then we build that back. And they've got to know that we're here to serve them, not them to serve us.
You mentioned trust and these audits. I think that is a big key, because what that really boils down to is you're demanding that the government is responsible and that it acts responsibly within its structure, but also certainly on the fiscal side of things. I mean, we see that kind of waste all the time in government.
Right. It's if we don't keep on top of it, which Dennis is doing now, if we don't keep on top of it. No, wasn't that Kate Brown's agency for a while?
Yeah.
So, you know, why all of a sudden does this, now these big numbers are popping up. Where were they before?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
doesn't change overnight. So, you know, I know you only got a minute left, but it's the key. It's the key to getting this thing turned around. And it's millions of those dollars. So
yeah, absolutely.
That money can go back into great, great plans and back to Oregonians if we can.
That's right. The fraud and waste is just astronomical, and you're right. We could be using that so much better. All right, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into his unique background and what his time in the Blue Angels taught him. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking with Greg Wooldridge, a Republican candidate for governor. He is a former Navy pilot and a commander of the world-famous Blue Angels, the only commander who ever led them on three tours. And I'd like to talk about your unique background. In fact, let's actually start there. Why is that unique that someone would lead the Blue Angels on three tours?
Yeah, Mark, it's usually a two-year tour, and then you leave the team. You talk about commanding the team. It's a player-coach type relationship. I'm out in the number one jet in front of the formation, and then when we get on the ground, of course, the whole time I'm responsible for the team. I take full responsibility as a commanding officer. So that's the relationship I had. Now, it's normally a two-year tour, what we call a tour, and then you go on and go do something else because it's pretty intense. This is something a lot of people don't know. The Blue Angels is just a part of a person's Navy tour or tour duty, their career. So So I did 2 years, and then I went away for about 6 months, and the commander of the team who had taken over from me had to step aside. But I came back for about a year, well, not quite a year, about 8-9 months, and led the team the rest of the time for him, which is unusual. And then about 2.5 years later, the guys on the team stopped wanting to fly with the leader. They were afraid he was going to kill them.
Wow.
So morale was rock bottom, and I was getting ready to retire from the Navy, and I got called from Washington. They said, would you consider coming back? And I said, well, stretch out my retirement date, and sure, I'll do it.
Hmm.
With no guarantees, because I hadn't flown in 2.5 years. And I went back, and we got it together and had a very successful season after that. So those are my three times. Occasionally, some guys will do it twice in extremis for somebody, but never three times.
Hmm. Well, I think it must say something about you that your commanders wanted you back for that third time. One of the things that people may not know about the Blue Angels, and I mentioned this in the last segment, is that it's not just these pilots who have to have extreme precision. I mean, you're flying like 3 feet away from your wingman there, and you're flying at 400 miles an hour. But it's the entire team, the ground crew and so on, who all have to be high performers. One little mistake, one little screw not tightened down, and it could be a complete disaster. Talk to us about what it takes to lead a precision team where everything has to go right and everyone has to do their job 100% right 100% of the time.
Right. It goes back to that trust factor. We build that trust. We have a culture of excellence. So culture in any organization is so critical. We said thank you a lot. We shook hands a lot. And one of our catchphrases was glad to be here. Mm-hmm. And that reflected that thankfulness, that gratitude to get to work with the people we got to work with. Now, there were 6 planes in the air that flew, the 6 of us, and we were flashing around, as George Will would say, in any event or any organization, there's the group that are the lightning. You know, they flash around. It could be the sales, people in sales that are out there with the public, but in the background is the thunder. The thunder is the strength of the organization.
Mm.
The men and women that gave us the airplanes to fly, that filed the files, that swept the floors, no matter what they did, they had ownership in the outcomes of that team, and they felt it, they knew it, and they took pride in that, and it was so cool.
You know, and I think that certainly taps into a lot of what Trump was saying, too, in his successful run, is that it's those people that are so often forgotten. You know, I used to call him the forgotten man, and forgotten
right.
No longer. But I hear elements of that in what you're saying, is that it's those people behind the scenes that often don't get the credit, but everybody knows they're so critical to how an organization runs.
Well, and that's an important part of leadership. You start from the top. You make that known that you appreciate everybody in your organization. I mean, I would every, you know, when I go into an office to meet with someone that I'm going to give a presentation to, the person that greets me, I learn their name. I share thoughts with them because I know how important their job is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to, and sometimes you could say the first person you see in an outfit is the VP of first impressions. So,
yeah.
You know, and so it's very important to recognize that everybody has a major role in the success of the enterprise. So,
well, I know that because we in my MBA days and also in my doctorate level, we studied high performance teams. And that mm-hmm. is something that always kind of mystified me, where so much attention is put on the C-suite, where you've got, you know, the CEOs mm-hmm. and the chief financials and, you know, the C's and the various acronyms. But so right. little attention is given to the front men, as you say. And it's often a shame to me that so many companies invest so much in those upper-level managers in terms of time and development and everything else. But then it's those people, like you say, that make the first impression that don't get paid as much as they ought to be, that get overlooked, that don't get the trainings, that don't get everything else. And a lot of times it's a thankless job, and yet it is so critical to that organization's success. So how do you then start translating that into efficiency within government?
That's a good one. Again, you have to give people expectations.
Hmm.
If you don't outline
yes.
clear yeah. and bold expectations, people are going to wander. They're going
yes.
to wander. I call it in my training, I call it having a center point. People need to have a center point well defined with how you expect them to get it done, and then you give them feedback. You know, you can let them just flounder along and not be doing the right job, but you've got to give feedback. You can expect what you inspect, kind of is the thing. And So to get the inefficiency out of government, it just starts from the top down, and you build those expectations and work on it. So it can be done.
Yeah, and then hold them responsible for not meeting those expectations. All right,
exactly.
Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Greg Wooldridge. He is a Republican candidate for governor. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show, talking with Greg Wooldridge. He is running for the Republican nomination for the governor of Oregon. This has been a get-to-know-you kind of interview, and then we'll have him back a little bit later on to talk about policy a little bit more in depth. And in case you're just joining us, he is a retired Navy captain and former commander of the Navy Blue Angels. See, I should mention that you weren't just the commander of that's a minor accomplishment. You weren't just the commander of the Navy Blue Angels, but you were a commander of a naval base as well.
That was... You know what? Everybody says, Lloyd, leading the Blue Angels must have been the pinnacle of your career. Actually, being able to build a team and lead that base, the biggest Navy jet base in the country, a fantastic place, but out in the middle of the cotton fields of Central California, but a great place to raise kids and do flight operations, which was our charter. But it was like a small state. It had everything. It had airport with two 13,500-foot runways. We had hospitals. We had stores. We had schools. We had public safety, you know, security, everything you could imagine in a state. And I had such a great team, yet the responsibility came back to me. Whenever things went wrong, it was right on me, and that's fine. And I accepted that, and I thrived on that. Going after making things work right and being open and answerable.
Well, and responsibility is just something you don't hear very often when it comes to government workers or government anything. We hear about $300 million wasted on a study to determine whether or not we need a bridge crossing the Columbia.
Right.
Billions of dollars are wasted every year on various programs. I know that, you know, one of our big bugaboos when it comes to the environment is the amount of waste on global warming studies. Fiscal year 2014, the Obama White House spent $22.2 billion on global warming initiatives over the possibility that maybe if we do everything that they say over the next 50 years, we might lower the Earth's temperature by half a degree. It's just an astonishing amount of the waste there, and that there just never seems to be any responsibility. In terms of actually firing people from government, where do you stand on that? How do you get them? How do you end up firing them when there are so many protections to keep them there?
Right. Well, that's a good question. But if you can absolutely prove that there's negligence, then they have to go. Frankly, I'm a believer in second chances when that's allowable, you know, because sometimes you can engender incredible loyalty if you can give somebody a second chance.
Sure.
If they haven't done
Something
intentionally, maliciously, or, you know, totally out of the realm of acceptance. However, if you've got people in positions of authority and they are willfully or knowingly doing something that isn't along the goals or in the line with the goals of the organization, you have to be able to fire them. And we'll fight to do that. When that comes up in the state, we will fight to do that. And I know there'll be those that'll try to protect them, but we'll work with the unions and other folks, and we'll show people that it's best for the state. And, you know, you have to be a shepherd of the state's money and make sure that people are getting their money's worth.
Absolutely. You know, we've talked about efficiency on a number of levels. Just looking at the government in rather broad terms right now, are there areas in particular that you see as especially wasteful?
Well, I think one of Dennis Richardson's finds about Medicaid was the 14% of the folks that got services that weren't entitled to them, to the tune of $72 million. And then there's another, 70% that we're not sure that haven't responded, that we haven't made that determination yet. That's a big area where we can cut back waste. And there are several more that just need to be looked at real closely. But big numbers, millions.
Oh, absolutely.
Millions, hundreds of millions.
Yeah, hundreds of millions. I know within the Oregon Health Authority, there's a tremendous amount of waste. And now, of course, with that new health care tax, as we discussed last week, that new health care tax that we just put in, they're already looking to divert some of those funds into things that they had said they would never do and never mentioned when they got that passed as well. In the minute and a half or 2 minutes or so that we've got here with you, I'd like to return to something. You use this simple phrase, glad to be here, as part of your efforts to get more efficiency out of people. And that's deceptively simple, I think, especially when you look at government and how many people in government actually say that. I mean, that they're glad to be here. I know that when I've gone into government buildings, a lot of them seem this is almost like torture for them to be here. I just think if you could get people within government to really have that notion of being glad to be here, that alone would raise a lot of efficiency right there.
It has to start at the top. You know, yes. You have to reject that your gratitude for having the people that are around you. And once you do that and it filters down along with that glad to be here, because you have a gratitude and a thank you for them being with you and helping you and doing the right job, it builds that culture, it builds that mindset. But along with that comes respect. So you respect the people that you're glad to be with. And when that respect filters down, that also builds a sense of oneness and team and ownership. And that's what we're looking for. We want people to feel like they own outcomes. When the outcomes are good, that's strong. When they're fair, let's work on getting it better. We can do better. You know, we can make this happen. Let's take a look. How are we going to do this? You know, so it is. It's a great motto. It just has real deep meaning.
So it's January 2019. You're governor. What needs to be fixed in Oregon first, you think?
My top three are education, infrastructure, getting those roads built, getting those 72 failing bridges rebuilt, and opening up lanes of commerce. If we can't get the commerce moving and moving fast, we're not going to build the tax base up by encouraging people to be here. Education, I'll go back to that. We've got to do better with our young people. I mean, they are failing and leaving school. And then PERS, we got to take a close look PERS and get that fixed. I got some great ideas on doing that with a couple of real brains that I'm going to pull in. So those are my first three, and we're going to get after it.
Those are certainly big chunks to take out. And if you can accomplish those in your first term, that would be awesome. Greg Wooldridge, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We'll definitely have to have you back.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here anytime.
There's an article on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com that we found actually through Greg. It's about a political witch hunt, a classic example of government not wanting to be held accountable or responsible. A mom had gotten involved in the Portland School District, and Dennis Richardson appointed her to the State Board of Education. Except the board doesn't like being held accountable, so they have tried everything to get rid of her. They tried to change their own rules, even enlisting the help of the legislature to try to get her removed.
That's the kind of thinking that Greg is talking about that needs changed, where Salem actually wants to be held responsible to the people they're supposed to be serving, not run from it. You can find that at iSpyRadio.com, links to Greg's website, his Twitter feed, and more, and give us a follow, too, at iSpyRadio, and help us spread the word, won't you? Because, as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.